Are stents or surgery better for treating blocked vessels in the heart?
And is cardiac screening indicated for all individuals?
Should we image when people have low back pain?
And do pathologists agree when they're interpreting breast biopsy specimens?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on March 20th, 2015, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Science System in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, let's reveal to our listeners who are very sensitive to recordings that we put out that you're on the phone today. We're having some technical issues that we hope to overcome by next week. Let's turn then to the studies. Since you're a cardiologist and it's also the American College of Cardiology meeting this week.
Just completed.
Okay. Why don't we turn to this issue, and it's a big issue, of course, of should we place stents or should we do coronary artery bypass grafting when folks have blocked blood vessels in their hearts? That's published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
We should first start off by saying not everybody needs to have their blocked heart vessels treated with either surgery or stents. Oftentimes, medications can be very effective. But for those individuals in whom it is deemed appropriate to undergo either stenting or bypass surgery, what we'll call revascularization therapy, which therapy is better? And this is somewhat of a moving target because although we've been doing surgery for decades and the techniques have improved early on, they've been relatively stable over the last several decades, but the stenting procedure has improved substantially, starting first with routine bare metal stents or a scaffold to hold the blood vessel open, and then coating in with drugs prevent a recurrent blockage from occurring, and then a second generation of these drug-eluting stents. That's what these studies addressed. How did they stack up compared to surgery? Well, there were two studies, one an observational study, and the other is a randomized trial. First, the observational study. There were almost 35,000 patients. Over 9,000 underwent stent placement, and so they matched them to 9,000 similar patients who underwent bypass surgery. What they discovered was that the risk of death was similar regardless of whether one had stenting done or had bypass surgery done. But the use of stenting was associated with a higher risk of having a heart attack in the future and of needing a repeat procedure, but a lower risk of stroke. Now, these results were confirmed in the randomized trial. They tried to get 1,800 patients enrolled. They had to stop at 880 because of slow enrollment, but the results were very similar.
So, you and I have gone back and forth about this before, about the durability of results relative to CABG, coronary artery bypass grafting, or to stent placement, with stents, of course, having a higher rate of restenosis. How would you, with that background, interpret these current findings?
Well, I think the great value is when you have the information, you want to involve the patient in that decision-making process. You have to allow them to either balance the short-term risk of stroke associated with surgery versus the long-term consequences of having a heart attack or repeat procedure with PCI. In that way, you put it in the context of what the individual's values and preferences are. We can give them precise figures. For example, in the observational studies, the risk of a heart attack over the next several years was 1.9% with stenting versus 1.1% with bypass surgery. Risk of stroke, 0.7%. with stenting and 1% with bypass surgery. I think these figures can really help a person put it in a good context if I figure out which one is most pertinent or valuable to them.
Right, I get that. On the other hand, I would also say one study I'd like to see is what is the rate of restenosis if other factors are taken into consideration, lipid lowering and so forth, when stenting is done?
Well, when does restenosis cause symptoms that would require repeat procedures? And in this particular study, it was 7% when a stent was used and 3% with bypass surgery. So I think that answers that question.
In the presence of really good lipid-lowering therapy and so forth?
Absolutely. The revascularization doesn't replace medical therapy. It's done in addition to it. So you're right. All these patients were put on appropriate aspirin and cholesterol-lowering and other medications that could be beneficial.
Still moving target, I guess, until we really perfect the stent.
I agree.
Let's move from here then to the other kind of end of this spectrum. Is it appropriate for us to screen people who are at low risk for cardiac disease? That's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
And there's a great amount of interest in trying to screen individuals because we know that cardiovascular disease results in one of every three deaths in the United States. And the thought process would be, well, gosh, if we can screen those individuals accurately and then apply some therapy that would lower the risk, screening could be useful. Well, this is a clinical guideline paper that tries to summarize data over decades. In essence, what they recommend is that cardiac screening has not been shown to improve patient outcomes in low-risk patients. In fact, it could be associated with potential harms because there are false positive results that oftentimes lead to additional studies. Sometimes they involve radiation exposure and sometimes involve revascularization procedures that really don't lower the subsequent risk. So because these individuals have a low likelihood of having disease, they're recommending that clinicians should not screen for cardiac disease in asymptomatic, low-risk adults.
I like that. And since we're talking about screening, I'm going to go straight to the Journal of the American Medical Association, or imaging anyway, and take a look at the study saying, what's the benefit of imaging for low back pain in older folks who present with this condition?
This has been a controversial subject, not because it hasn't been studied in other patients. For example, it's recommended in younger adults that they not have routine imaging. But there are several organizations that have recommended that imaging be applied to older individuals with back pain because they have a higher risk of having, for example, cancer or infection, and you wouldn't want to miss that if that was the case. So this study was a prospective cohort study of over 5,200 patients over the age of 65 who had a new primary care visit for back pain. And of these individuals, over 1,100 had routine back x-rays, and about 350 had either an MRI or a CT scan within 6 weeks of the development of symptoms. And they matched those to very similar individuals that either didn't have a back x-ray or didn't have a CT or MRI. And the question was, at the end of a year, did the people that have imaging do better? And what they discovered is that among these older patients, early imaging was not associated with better one-year outcomes. There was only one individual that had cancer. So routine early imaging or just routine back pain wasn't really helpful even in older individuals.
Good news. Yet one more reason to escape imaging if it's possible to do so. Yeah, I like that. If we can avoid these imaging things, I think that's really a good thing. Finally, then, let's turn to, again, more findings that are usually found at imaging and then followed up with breast biopsy. What about those? That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
Since breast pathology diagnosis provides the basis for treatment and management decisions, it's really important to know how accurate it is. And that's what this study tried to assess, specifically to quantify the magnitude of disagreement among pathologists compared with a consensus panel that already had made a diagnosis, and to evaluate the patient and pathology characteristics that decided whether their diagnosis was similar or dissimilar. This was a study of pathologists who routinely interpret breast biopsies in clinical practice in 8 states in the United States. They gave 60 breast biopsies. These cases have already been reviewed by 3 expert panel members. And these breast biopsies, some contain frank invasive cancer, what's called carcinoma in situ, that is early cancer that's confined. Some were absolutely benign, and some just contained atypical breast cells. And of the over 2,000 interpretations, they agreed pretty well if there was invasive cancer, 96% of the time. And they agreed pretty well if it looked like it was a benign biopsy, 87% of the time. And even if there was early cancer, carcinoma in situ, agreed 84% of the time. But where they had difficulty was in the atypical breast samples, and they only agreed about 50% of the time. Where is there most disagreement? And there was higher disagreement among biopsies for women that had high breast density on their mammograms, and there was higher disagreement among pathologists who interpreted a lower weekly case volume, or who worked in smaller practices, or who were in non-academic settings.
Before I say, hey, women, if you have a biopsy, send it off to a pathologist who reads these things in his or her sleep at an academic center, I guess I would also say that this points to the need for some kind of standardization that could somehow be objective.
And that's exactly what the editorialist mentioned. On either side of the spectrum, whether it's benign or malignant, there was agreement. It's in that middle range where it's a little fuzzy and the definitions aren't quite as strict. And either getting either more clearly defined criteria or having molecular markers would be particularly helpful. For atypia, atypical cells, if women are thought to have an increased risk of cancer, let's say, for example, they have a family history or other risk factors, then they're oftentimes put on some sort of chemoprophylactic therapy. That is tamoxifen in premenopausal women or some of the aromatase inhibitors in postmenopausal women. So it does affect the treatment recommendation in those individuals. So, Elizabeth, you're right, getting better diagnostic criteria. Now, in fairness, here are some of the limitations of the study. They weren't allowed to consult with other pathologists, and that's frequently the case. If it's not quite clear-cut, oftentimes they'll call in another specialist or they'll do secondary cuts to look at it again, and that wasn't allowed here. So this was the hardest way to do this study. And there are ways, even in routine practice, we can make the results more concordant.
On that positive note then, and of course these molecular markers are coming apace, so I suspect we're going to have those in place in the not too distant future. I'll reveal that this week on the blog, I think I'm going to do the stents versus CABG in the New England Journal of Medicine. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.